What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open.
In the 1960s, radical change came to American poetry.
First, are you our sort of person?
A thinking woman sleeps with monsters.
Won't you celebrate with me what I have shaped into a kind of life?
Women's voices started to ring out in an art form historically dominated by men.
Women have been liberated to write about anything they want to.
I am the history of rape. I am the history of the rejection of who I am.
From the Poetry Foundation in Chicago, this is A Change of World. I'm Meryl Streep. In the next hour, we're going to hear how the women's movement changed poetry and how women poets work together to change the culture.
For the first time in the history of writing, which is about 4,000 years or so, women could write without fear, without constantly looking over their shoulder to see if they were going to be approved of by men.
Let me give you, for those of you who are really young, just an image of how bizarre life was before the women's movement. Some of these things will shock you. During the 1950s...
In a recent lecture, historian Ruth Rosen talked about what life was like for American women in the 1950s and early 60s. Classified employment ads in the newspaper, for example, were segregated by sex.
If you're a woman and you wanted to become something else that was listed under men, like plumber, forget it. You couldn't get an apprenticeship. Banks refused to give women credit or loans. Your husband or your father had to sign for loans. No women were on the Supreme Court. No women were headed corporations. And if you can believe this, as late as 1970, a very famous doctor got on television and said, "Women are too hormonally disturbed to become the president."
The first wave of feminism won for women the right to vote in 1920. But women were still second-class citizens in every sphere of private and public life, including the literary world.
It was completely an old boys' club.
Women poets were, first of all, discouraged from existing. It was not women's place. If they existed, they were disparaged and condescended to.
Let's just put it this way. If you were female, that was one thing against you. You would have to sort of overcome the factor of your gender, not to mention your race, in order to get your book published.
Honor Moore, Alicia Ostreicher, and Joan Larkett are poets who came of age during the second wave of feminism, during the women's movement of the 1960s and 70s. Prior to the 60s, most magazines, journals, and book publishers were run by men, and few women were published. When they were, was usually poems flavored by quaint, feminine domesticity. There were exceptions, though.
What is our innocence? What is our guilt?
A few female poets did make it into the front ranks of the literary establishment, like Marianne Moore.
The unanswered question, the resolute doubt.
And later, Elizabeth Bishop.
Down by one of the fish houses, an old man sits netting. His net, in the gloaming, almost invisible, a dark purple...
Moore and Bishop made their marks in the poetry world with their meticulous observations and mastery of form. But they avoided writing openly about their personal lives. In general, women poets knew it was much easier to get published if they kept their experiences as women out of their poems. And if a magazine or press published one or two women, editors seemed to feel their work was done.
Hello?
When poet Carolyn Forché was first starting out, she took note of this literary tokenism, and she has a funny way of describing it.
When I was a younger poet, I looked at photographs, formal group portraits of American poets, poets such as Howard Nemiroff, W.H. Auden, Robert Lowell. And often in these portraits, there would be a woman seated in a small chair in the front of the group, and most of the poets would be standing or leaning casually against desks surrounding her. And in the earliest ones that I saw, the woman was Marianne Moore. And in a subsequent version, I saw the woman was Elizabeth Bishop. I began to call this little chair the blue velvet chair because it appeared to be cushioned. It appeared to be almost Victorian.
The problem was there was only one blue velvet chair for women. But change was coming, and it started with books.
We had to break through the feminine mystique and the definition, the mask of false femininity we were wearing.
In 1963, Betty Friedan published The Feminine Mystique, a founding document of second-wave feminism. It was based on surveys and interviews of American housewives and demonstrated just how oppressed modern women really were.
Equality for personhood for women meant a radical restructuring of the institutions of society that are based on it.
For poetry, change was also sparked by a book.
Daddy, you can lie back now.
Well, Ariel changed things for women poets.
This is Honor Moore.
Sylvia Plath's Ariel.
They always knew it was you. Daddy, daddy, you bastard, I'm through.
She didn't see herself as a feminist because she died before second wave feminism began. So let's get that straight. She died the same year that Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique was published.
Sylvia Plath's constrained life as a wife and mother vividly illustrated the feminine mystique. She had two young children and was estranged from her husband, the British poet Ted Hughes, when she committed suicide in 1963. She was 30 years old. A few years after her death, Hughes published her final poems in a collection called Ariel. The book had an electric effect on poets involved in the women's movement, like Joan Larkin.
It was a revelation. It was the most passionate and intimate book of poems that I had encountered. And, of course, it was a woman writing about her experience without the filter of male approval.
She was the first courage giver for me and for my generation. It was thrilling to read her.
Alicia Ostreicher is a poet and scholar who's written extensively about women's poetry.
I was a young mother. I had two in diapers, and someone sent me Ariel. I read it when everyone else in the apartment was asleep, and I was just about out of my skin with excitement.
What we started to name as feminist in Sylvia Plath's poetry was the notion of the woman poet being the agent in her poems. You read a poem and you say, oh my God, that's exactly what I'm feeling. But you're not Sylvia Plath, so you didn't write The Applicant.
The Applicant is a satiric poem about marriage in the guise of an interview.
First, are you our sort of person?
We never hear from the applicant, who seems to be a young man without any purpose in life. The interviewer presents the young man with a solution to all his problems, a wife.
Come here, sweetie, out of the closet. Well, what do you think of that? Naked as paper to start, but in 25 years she'll be silver, in 50, gold. A living doll everywhere you look. It can sew, it can cook, it can talk.
She was so out there emotionally, and primarily she could express the anger that most of us suppressed, the self-destructiveness that most of us were in fact living through, but she took further. What was surprising was her freedom.
Dying is an art, like everything else. I do it exceptionally well.
In poems like Lady Lazarus, Plath turned white-hot anger into cold print.
Out of the ash, I rise with my red hair, and I eat men like air.
Ariel was the catalyst for a generation of women poets who would remake American poetry in the coming decades. But there were others who also came to electrify this generation. Others who put a woman's experience at the center of their poems, who exploded the boundaries of what women and men could write about. One of them was Sylvia Plath's friend and former classmate, Anne Sexton.
Anne Sexton had talent to burn. She was so gifted.
When she put her first manuscript together, she had a section of poems about what it was like to be in a mental hospital.
Anne Sexton's first mentor, the poet John Holmes, told her she shouldn't publish those poems. So she wrote, "To John, who bids me not to inquire further."
Not that it was beautiful, but that, in the end, there was a certain sense of order there. Something worth learning in that narrow diary of my mind. In the commonplaces of the asylum, where the cracked mirror of my own selfish death outstared me.
And the point is, a poet needs to inquire and not blindfold herself and not muffle herself.
Something I would never find in a lovelier place, my dear. Although your fear is anyone's fear. Like an invisible veil between us all.
I think it's a great poem because it's saying that censorship is what she calls a veil between us all that punishes all of us.
And sometimes, in private, my kitchen, my face, your face.
Anne Sexton's first collection, To Bedlam and Partway Back, was published in 1960, before The Feminine Mystique. The book was followed by others that put the intimate details of Sexton's life increasingly on display, her body, her sexuality, her ongoing struggles with mental illness.
I think Sexton was probably one of the early poets who got criticized for her content because she was really she didn't bother to put her female experience into a myth or into some kind of intellectual context. She just wrote the Ballad of the Lonely Masturbator.
Well, the effect it had on critics was it horrified them. You can't do that. You can't say that. Her sexuality was considered disgusting by the critics. And at that time, the critics were men, and the female body in its femaleness as a subject, not an object for its beauty, but as a subject which experiences what a body experiences, was disgusting.
In spite of her popularity, Sexton's poems were often met with condescension. Poet James Dickey wrote, "Miss Sexton's work seems to me very little more than a kind of terribly serious and determinedly outspoken soap opera." Unlike Marianne Moore and Elizabeth Bishop, Anne Sexton never sat in that blue velvet chair. Like Sylvia Plath before her, Sexton committed suicide. For Joan Larkin and many poets of her generation, this was troubling.
I had a double response to these two women poets. They were givers of permission to explore that intimate material of our own lives, of my own life. They were good poets, too. I mean, wonderful craft, wonderful voice. At the same time, there was something very irritating and angering about the fact that they were, you know, the two suicides, the two crazy women who were finally the women who appeared in the anthologies that we were reading.
There were many others out there. They just weren't as well known. When Sexton died in 1974, women poets were writing and publishing in unprecedented numbers. Denise Levertov, June Jordan, Maxine Kuman, Fanny Howe, Marge Piercy, Nikki Giovanni, Jean Valentine, Toy Derricotte, Louise Glick, Marilyn Hacker, these are just a few of the poets who came of age on the wings of the women's movement and whose extraordinarily diverse work would soon transform American poetry. We'll be back after the break. From the Poetry Foundation in Chicago, you're listening to A Change of World, How the Women's Movement Changed Poetry, and How Women Poets Work Together to Change the Culture. I'm Meryl Streep. The National Book Awards Ceremony, New York City, 1974. By all accounts, it was a weird event that year. Thomas Pynchon didn't show up to collect his prize for best novel. He sent a comedian instead. At one point in the ceremony, a naked man streaked through the hall shouting, "Read books! Read books!" The award for poetry that year went to not one, but two poets, Allen Ginsberg and Adrienne Rich.
Oh, it's going to Adrienne Rich for this very radical book, Diving into the Wreck. Amazing. Amazing.
Honor Moore remembers when the award was announced.
It has an iconically feminist poem, or a poem that restates the cultural context for poetry.
And this is called Diving into the Wreck. First, having read the Book of Myths and loaded the camera and checked the edge of the knife blade, I put on the body armor of black rubber, the absurd flippers, the grave and awkward mask.
Diving into the Wreck was the title poem of Rich's winning book. The speaker is a female deep-sea diver exploring a sunken ship.
It uses a sustained metaphor, diving into the wreck.
Alicia Ostreicher.
The wreck can be history. It can be our society. It can be literature. It can be what has happened to all women all through time.
I came to explore the wreck. The words are purposes. The words are maps. I came to see the damage that was done and the treasures that prevail.
This poem is a kind of battle cry, but it's a communal battle cry.
A book of myths in which our names do not appear.
For the National Book Awards ceremony, Adrienne Rich had made a plan with two of her fellow nominees, Alice Walker and Audre Lorde. If any of them won, she would accept the award on behalf of the others. The ceremony wasn't recorded. But this is how Adrienne Rich began her acceptance speech, as read by her fellow poet, Sonia Sanchez.
We, Audre Lorde, Adrienne Rich, and Alice Walker together accept this award in the name of all the women whose voices have gone and still go unheard in a patriarchal world, and in the name of those who, like us, have been tolerated as token women in this culture, often at great cost and in great pain. We believe
it had the ring of kind of sacrifice, in the sense of, oh my God, she is giving up soloness for us. We're in this together as women. Every woman's oppression is my oppression, that idea which came out of the radical feminist movement.
We dedicate this occasion to the struggle for self-determination of all women of every color, identification, or derived class, the poet, the housewife, the lesbian, the mathematician, the mother, the dishwasher.
It was shocking. Feminism had no sort of standing in the culture. It was courageous in the sense that none of these three poets would ever be accepted or considered in the same way again.
Sonia Sanchez.
She chose two black women to go up there. And she was actually saying, too, the subtext is that you don't honor black women, you don't honor black folks with these bloody awards here. So we must then get up and then share those awards with other people that, you know, this country was ignoring, period.
This was an announcement to the world that we are a movement. There is a movement of poets, a movement of women poets, and we speak not just for ourselves, but for each other.
Joan Larkin.
I think it was part of the ethos of the movement that every woman mattered, and we weren't participating in the mainstream rewards systems. I mean, forget about getting tenure at a university if you were teaching.
We symbolically join together here in refusing the terms of patriarchal competition and declaring that we will share this prize among us to be used as best we can for women.
The three poets who banded together to accept the National Book Award went on to make enormous contributions to the culture, each in her own way. Adrienne Rich's poems and essays had already become essential reading for the women's movement. Alice Walker became a celebrated novelist and an activist. And Audre Lorde broke new ground for what could be said in poetry and who could say it.
I'm thinking of her poem called Love Poem.
Joan Larkin admires Lorde for putting herself so fully into her poems.
It's clearly an embrace of self, an embrace of other women that went very deep. It wasn't just rhetoric. It was coming out of the life she lived.
And I knew when I entered her, I was high wind in her forest's hollows, fingers whispering sound. Honey flowed from the split cup, impaled on a lance of tongues, on the tips of her breasts, on her navel, and my breath howling into her entrances through lungs of pain.
If you could say that Rich and Plath and Sexton plowed the field for women poets, in particular white women poets, what Audre Lorde did was to plow the field for African-American women poets, both gay women poets and sexual women poets.
The openness toward lesbianism was thrilling to many women, and not only lesbians, because it was openness to the truth of her body and her feelings, and that is what we were all afraid of and desiring.
She embraced her sexuality, she embraced her sensuality, and she embraced her anger. She was amazingly bold with her fury.
Audre Lorde, the poem Power, where she speaks of a police shooting.
A policeman who shot down a 10-year-old in Queens stood over the boy with his cop shoes and childish blood, and a voice said, "Die, you little motherfucker," and there are tapes to prove it. In his trial, this policeman said, in his own defense, "I didn't notice the size or nothing else, only the color, and there are tapes to prove that, too."
Then she goes on in the poem to criticize the jury who acquitted that police officer.
Camille Dungy is a poet, professor, and anthologist.
The poem has a lot to do with what is the cost to all of us if we individually relinquish our power to resist tyranny and violence.
Poor thing, she never hurt a soul. What beasts they are.
The history of second wave feminism and poetry was collective, a story about how women poets worked together for change. Susan Griffin came of age in the 1960s. She says that women poets had to create their own communities before the world would listen.
Well, you know, what's interesting is when you feel marginalized, to move to articulate it is a complicated process. Most people don't just go directly from marginalization to giving voice to it. What has to happen in between is a community. And how does this community evolve? That's the $64,000 question.
In the 1960s and 70s, poetry readings played an important role in social movements.
We have the civil rights movement, we have gay and lesbian rights movement, we have the women's movement.
Poet and scholar Elizabeth Alexander.
I would argue that actually artists and poets are always at the forefront of pushing those ideas forward.
All right, 1 minute before that.
I think of myself as a violent woman who tries, like the members of AA, I try not to be violent one more day. Waking this morning.
But what's available is a pointing finger attached to a hand.
Readings in New York, Boston, L.A., and San Francisco brought together new communities of women poets and readers.
Oh, let's go to a reading.
Rachel says, without this voice, we are dispossessed.
I'm a shouting woman. I'm a speech woman. I'm an atmosphere woman. I'm an airtight woman.
Going to a reading was a thing you did with your lesbian girlfriend or your feminist consciousness-raising group or your friend, much more than now. The people who came weren't just poets.
It wasn't unusual to have an audience of 1,000 people. In those days, poetry readings were big social occasions. Everybody went to them. Many, many women, but there were also men.
Go here. This poet is going to read. You've got to hear her, you know. And it was sort of like going to hear a folk singer.
They were such fervent days. It's hard to really communicate how outrageous that we ourselves felt we were being. We were just crossing so many boundaries. You know, we talked about sex. We talked about love between women. We complained about housework.
I think we were so excited by and hungry for hearing what other women had to say.
One of the things poetry does is it puts into language things that you haven't thought of in a language. So at a time when the women's movement was changing people's lives, and a woman would not be able to wash the dishes again, you know, she might go to a poetry reading and hear a poem in which a woman is talking about being tired of washing the dishes.
This is a poem for a woman doing dishes. This is a poem for a woman doing dishes. It must be repeated. It must be repeated again and again, again and again.
Because the woman doing dishes has trouble hearing. So that's a poem made out of this horrible, boring thing that you're doing all the time. But it's a poem. So that's what poetry readings were like. Suddenly your life was not just your life, it was everyone's life, and it was worth singing about. You know, it functioned like consciousness raising in a way, except it was literature.
Something ignites in which people who've been muttering things to each other or whispering to each other suddenly start saying them out loud. And in mirroring each other, we affirm and validate each other's experience and validate our feeling of outrage and the feeling that the way we've been treated is unjust. And so as the community, the women's community formed, that allowed for certain stories to be told and certain music to arise. I think of poetry as a kind of music. Songs to be sung, let's put it that way.
In 1974, a young poet by the name of Judy Grahn showed up in New York City. A small reading was hastily arranged. Someone asked Honor Moore to attend.
She is this amazing poet from San Francisco, and she's reading at West Beth tonight. Maybe you could tell Adrienne, Rich.
Rich, Moore, and about a dozen others got together to hear a new poet read a long poem called A Woman is Talking to Death. This was one of the main ways new poetry got around in those pre-internet days.
It was in a very bare room, sort of fluorescent lights and ugly chairs. And I remember Judy being at that time a small, wiry, fierce presence.
She was a dyke. She dressed very boyishly. She was working class. So she had sort of the female equivalent of sort of a Johnny Cash presence.
And she's in this kind of trance, and she says, One. Testimony and trials.
Testimony and trials that never got heard. My lover's teeth are white geese flying above me. My lover's muscles are rope ladders under my hands.
And she goes on, and it's like you're suddenly in this dimension. You know, it's not Diving into the Wreck, and it's not an Audre Lorde poem, and it's not a Sylvia Plath poem. It's something else.
Oh, it's a great poem. Epic poem. She manages to conjure the denial of death, the denial of mortality, that fuels a lot of what we then called patriarchy.
Perhaps echoing Sylvia Plath's The Applicant, the poem includes this mock interrogation.
Have you ever held hands with a woman? Yes, many times. Women about to deliver, women about to have breasts removed, wombs removed, miscarriages. Women having epileptic fits, having asthma, cancer. Women having breast bone marrow sucked out of them by... And women who were happy, who were celebrating, who were dancing with me or in large circles or alone. Women who were climbing mountains or up and down walls or trucks or roofs and needed a boost up, or I did. Women who simply wanted to hold my hand because they liked me. Some women who wanted to hold my hand because they liked me better than anyone.
It's all at this extraordinary level of intensity, and it's about a feminist sensibility that includes poverty, that includes people of another race, that is not anti-male, that is, I love women.
What about kissing? Have you kissed any women? I have kissed many women.
It was so exciting. I was so excited that I'd been there.
The poetry readings were almost like a ritual for this new community and culture that was evolving. We were defining culture outside the boundaries that we were taught in school. And we were claiming culture for ourselves.
Here's Judy Grahn today, reading a poem she wrote in the 1970s.
You are what is female. You shall be called Eve. And what is masculine shall be called God. And from your name, Eve, we shall take the word evil, and from God's, the word good. Now you understand patriarchal morality.
For poetry by women to flourish and find a bigger audience, it needed support from magazines and publishers, from colleges and universities, from the literary establishment. In the 1960s, women poets had very little institutional support.
When I was a student at Sarah Lawrence, I had many very difficult times. That was when I discovered that poetry was a way of saving my life by helping me to, in some ways, forget it by writing.
This was Alice Walker in 1979 at the Library of Congress.
I wasn't thinking about publishing these poems. I was just thinking about getting through the night. And so I put them all in a little blue notebook. And this little blue notebook I stuck under the door of Muriel Rukeyser's cottage. She was the poet on campus. And Muriel took these poems and gave them to her agent, who gave them to a publisher, and that was how I started publishing.
Alice Walker graduated from college in 1966. The support she got from an established female poet was rare, if only because there were almost no female poets employed by universities. Even Muriel Rukeyser, a poet with many books and awards behind her, didn't have a tenured academic job. But by the 1970s, if you really wanted to study with Muriel, you could find her in New York City.
In the human cities, never again to despise the backside of the city, the ghetto, or build it again
as we build the despised backsides of houses, look at your own building. You are the city.
Since the 1930s, Rukeyser had been writing feminist poems with what Elizabeth Alexander calls an intersectional sense of justice.
She's thinking about African Americans and that struggle. She's writing about the Scottsboro Boys. She's an anti-war activist. She is an all-around progressive with women's self-empowerment and self-naming at the center of that.
Never to despise the homosexual who goes building another with touch, not to despise any touch, each like
each
himself,
like himself, like herself, each. You are this.
Among her readers in New York was poet Sharon Olds.
She had lived a whole life in a female body. Therefore, she knew 1,000 things that I knew. And then she knew another 1,000 I didn't know. And she was bisexual, so she knew a lot more than I knew.
In the body's ghetto, never to despise the clitoris in her least speech. Never to despise in myself what I have been taught to despise. Not to despise the other. Not to despise the it. To make this relation with the it. To know that I am it.
She was brave. In a way, it was more important to me that she was brave. And that has something to do with me growing up in an atmosphere where women were, although women had to be quite brave in many ways, weren't known for that quality.
Perhaps because role models were scarce and female mentors even scarcer, Olds didn't seek guidance for her own poetry until she was 30.
I had a big breakthrough and I started writing all the time. And I began to realize that I needed help. My poems were too sentimental. They were sort of self-pitying. I didn't know how to revise without taking out the rude stuff, which was not necessarily what I should take out of my poems. It might be, but it might not be. And I just happened to see in a newspaper, when I didn't read the newspaper, Muriel Rukeyser, Poetry Appreciation. What I needed was Muriel.
In the early 1970s, Olds attended a poetry class that Rukeyser taught at the 92nd Street Y, and Rukeyser soon became an important mentor. She later taught a private writing workshop out of her own apartment. Adrienne Rich, Audre Lorde, June Jordan, and many other poets also led workshops, including Honor Moore.
When I taught a workshop in my living room in 1977, I had this crazy idea that women poets wrote short lines because they didn't have the courage to write long lines. So I got everybody to write long-lined poems. But we were talking about getting our own experience into poems.
We had aroused this sleeping giant.
Judy Grahn taught workshops in the 1970s and still does today. She credits the women's movement for their popularity.
Women wanted to tell their life stories. They wanted to tell stories about things that had happened to them or had happened to their mothers or had happened to other people that they knew. I think what made it work was that absolute permission to come up with anything they wanted to talk about and write about.
It was akin to consciousness raising. In other words, it was to find in our own lives as women the subject matter that was forbidden in other workshops, not only taught by a male poet, but populated by, let's say, 10-to-1 men to women.
The content, as I discovered, women's content was, and still is to some extent, so controversial and so unheard of. It was such a new thing.
I have been raped because I have been wrong.
This is June Jordan reading Poem About My Rights.
The wrong nose, the wrong hair, the wrong need, the wrong dream, the wrong geographic, the wrong sartorial. I have been the meaning of rape. I have been the problem everyone seeks to eliminate by forced penetration with or without the evidence of slime. But let this be unmistakable. This poem is not consent.
I do not consent.
The workshop scene gave women poets the opportunity to talk to each other and to write for each other. Camille Dungy says this had a huge effect.
The spaces that were made by writers like Muriel Rukeyser to open the door for a Sharon Olds, no more masks, write who you are, how you are. And then the kinds of doors that Sharon Olds has been able to open in her career, it starts to expand exponentially.
There were so many things going on at once that contributed to that collaborative feeling. There were the presses, there were the magazines, there were the bookstores, there were the poetry readings, there were the consciousness-raising groups. And everything sort of, and the books, the women bookstores, and it all interpenetrated.
These new informal communities helped women poets survive and even thrive in what was still a sexist literary landscape.
I got a lot of rejection slips from editors who were all male, many of which were contemptuous, and a couple of which were scary.
Sharon Olds remembers submitting to journals in the 1970s.
These were love poems, many of them, and they had children in them. And the editor would say, if you wish to write about your children, may we suggest the Ladies' Home Journal? We are a literary magazine.
The problem for women poets wasn't just sexism. As Honor Moore remembers, she and other poets wanted to find their poetic voices as women.
Can I please, please put a pen in my hand and write what I really mean? Can I possibly find language for that? Well, where am I going to find the language? Where have poets always found language? By listening to other poets and making a shift.
In the struggle to learn how to say what they wanted to say, women poets went to readings, attended workshops, and looked to older poets for guidance. They also took a deep dive into literary history to see, as Adrienne Rich put it, the damage that was done and the treasures that prevail. More about that after the break. From the Poetry Foundation in Chicago, you're listening to A Change of World, How the Women's Movement Changed Poetry, and How Women Poets Work Together to Change the Culture. I'm Meryl Streep. In the late 1960s and early 70s, women poets wanted to see what kind of feminism might have been expressed by earlier generations of poets, and they were looking for models. This is Alicia Ostreicher.
If I wanted, and if we wanted women poets to be taken seriously, we had to look at the whole tradition from the 17th century to the present. As Virginia Woolf says, we think back through our mothers if we are women.
Honor Moore.
We discovered a tradition. The tradition was there in full sight.
But the tradition hadn't been taught in college and wasn't well represented in anthologies. The tradition of foremothers had to be reconstructed.
We continually had the attitude that the strong, powerful poems by women were being suppressed, and we were meant to find them.
'Twas mercy brought me from my pagan land.
Neglected African-American poets such as Phyllis Wheatley. and Alice Dunbar Nelson were rediscovered.
This pretty, futile seam, it stifles me. God, must I sit and sew?
Famous poets such as Anne Bradstreet and Emily Dickinson were reread from a feminist perspective.
I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody, too?
You know, modest, shy, self-deprecating Emily. Then in the next stanza,
how dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog. To tell your name the livelong day to an admiring bog.
Now, we have our public frogs. In fact, we have one I can think of right now.
Alicia Ostreicher noticed a pattern among women poets, even in the great Emily Dickinson.
A combination of rebellion and submission to a world in which what she was doing wasn't supposed to exist. Being assertive and taking it back. Being submissive and then turning it around.
Wild nights.
Demureness was one of her games. Another was eroticism.
Wild nights. Were I with thee, wild night should be our luxury.
Rowing in Eden. Ah, the sea. Don't tell me that Emily Dickinson didn't know what an orgasm was. She sure did.
If you can see why she feels that she kneels, if you can see why he knows that he shows what he bestows.
The experimental work of modernists, such as Gertrude Stein, was also reread from a feminist perspective. This is H.D., Hilda Doolittle.
Are you spirit? Are you sister? Are you brother? Are you alive? Are you dead?
And sometimes the female tradition was embodied in older poets who were very much alive. Kevin Young is the poetry editor for The New Yorker.
I mean, I think back to the poems of Gwendolyn Brooks, who I do think managed to write about womanhood and girlhood and childhood in the broadest senses. And, you know, her famous poem, The Mother, is very much about not having a child. I think that was really breaking powerful ground.
Abortions will not let you forget. You remember the children you got that you did not get. The damp, small pulps with a little or with no hair. The singers and workers that never handled the air. You will never neglect or beat them, or silence or buy with a sweet. You will never wind up the sucking thumb or scuttle off ghosts that come. You will never leave them controlling your luscious sigh, return for a snack of them with gobbling mother eye.
We don't think of her as a confessional poet, and therefore we kind of don't think of her as writing about personal matters. And I'm not saying these are autobiographical matters, but they are deeply personal and about everyday life.
This is a poem that's a very personal one for me. It was a time before I could write it, but I found after reading a poem called The Mother by Gwendolyn Brooks, her poem enabled me to be able to write clearly this poem, which is about an abortion. The Lost Baby Poem.
Lucille Clifton published her first book in 1969, when the women's movement and the black arts movement were in full swing. Her poems explored the intersections of race, gender, and class.
You would have been born into winter, in the year of the disconnected gas and no car. We would have made the thin walk over Genesee Hill into the Canada wind to watch you slip like ice into strangers' hands. If you would have fallen naked as snow into winter, if you were here, I could tell you these and some other things.
Once again, Camille Dungy.
I can write about what it means to need to have an abortion and the ways that that decision that I had to make has shaped the lives of the speaker of this poem, right? It's hard to understand that a poet like Lucille Clifton would have ever needed permission to use her voice in any way. But she herself admitted that reading Gwendolyn Brooks opened pathways to her that she didn't know were available to poetry.
I hit my head on the wall for years after having my daughter, just thinking, you know, at some point things will sort of calm down and I'll be able to write like I used to. And I think, like, they ain't gonna happen. Like, I just, life has changed, you know, and I have to learn to write in a different way.
Rosa Alcala is a poet and translator who shares a dilemma faced by many women poets. How to have a family, be a poet, and how to include the stuff of your life, birth, children, and family in your poems. Until the 1960s and 70s, there were few, if any, models for how to do this.
For me, the writers who really gave me permission were Bernadette Mayer and Alice Notley.
Mommy, what's this fork doing? What?
This is Alice Notley.
It's being Donald Duck. What could I eat this? Eat what? This cookie. What do you mean? What could I eat it?
They seemed to present a kind of poetry that felt as if children were just kind of part of the milieu, a part of what they were doing, of what was moving around them, right? There was literature and poetry at the same time, and that felt very accessible to me.
This is Bernadette Mayer.
No feeling, only moving beginning. The pain crashed, baby falls between loose pelvis onto the sheet. Watches leaves blow, wind onto window. Ecstatic poets bend over, watch the thin doctor.
Camille Dungy says the innovations of poets such as Bernadette Mayer, Alice Notley, and Lucille Clifton changed the very idea of what a poem could be about.
I, as a poet, can write about being a mother. I can write about caretaking my elders. I can write about a conversation that I had about groceries. And that's okay. The poetry doesn't have to speak to this rarefied space that's disconnected from the domestic, the sort of dailiness of our lives, which are very frequently the dailinesses of women's lives.
She also says they freed up a later generation of male poets, like Kevin Young.
This is a poem called Crowning, about the birth of my son.
There's a delightful, fascinating growth in the number of poems and collections by fathers about fatherhood. If Adrienne Rich had not written Of Woman Born and the poems that sort of came out of that flourishing of women talking about birth, about motherhood, what space would there be for fathers to talk about watching that experience of birth and experiencing that experience of birth?
The cord I cut like an iris pulsing.
Equality, full personage for women, meant a radical restructuring of the institutions of society that are based on it. But
the radical restructuring of society that Betty Friedan called for in 1963 is a work in progress. In poetry, too, equality has been elusive, and the aspirations of poets coming out of the women's movement have not been fully achieved.
It's not over yet.
Alicia Ostreicher.
I still encounter young women who feel as if they are being condescended to by their male mentors, as if they're being told what they should write and what they shouldn't write.
Joan Larkin.
There's still resistance to hearing women's voices to some extent. I think women are still second-class citizens in the world of publishing.
It is still the case that many journals will go as far as 30% women writers and no further.
Things have improved, but there is no such thing as done.
Elizabeth Alexander.
We are not living in a just society now, are we?
Full equality has not yet arrived, but many women poets today have academic jobs that were largely unobtainable in the 1960s. More women now work as magazine and book editors, and they also win more literary prizes.
I was born in Boston in 1949. I've never wanted this fact to be known. In fact, I've spent the better half of my adult life trying to sweep my early years under the carpet.
The communities of women poets that formed in the 1970s succeeded in creating new audiences for a huge variety of poetry by women.
I thought, well, I'll be a poet. What could be more foolish and obscure? I became a lesbian.
In the 1980s, poets such as Eileen Miles, who openly identified as queer, found enthusiastic audiences as the next generation of readings, workshops, and small presses took hold. By the early 90s, Maggie Nelson, a poet, scholar, and former student of Eileen Miles, could make this startling claim.
What I never had, I guess I'll say, is a poetry world where I felt like men were the gatekeepers or had things I wanted. You know, I wanted the world that Eileen represented. It was the kind of power that you create when you're making your own world, you know. And so we were making the world that we wanted and living in it, but we weren't asking anybody for anything.
This new world owes its existence to an earlier generation that was shaped by the women's movement. Yet later poets, building on that generation's achievements, sometimes point out its shortcomings.
In the process of making space for white women, many of those women had a particular kind of economic status that then might overlook working class women and often overlooked women of color.
I think about Lucille Clifton not being included in some second wave feminist accountings. She kept on doing her thing. And now everybody understands that Lucille Clifton is, you know, kind of the mother of everything.
Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed.
A woman like that is not a woman quite. I have been her kind.
My wedding ring lies in a basket, as if at the bottom of a well.
And now it is easy to forget what I came for, among so many who have always lived here, swaying their crenellated fans.
All of this work that I think we're speaking to here today was resisting its own silencing, its own erasure.
With my female blade, I'll carve my name in your most aspiring palm.
What they're saying is women's experience is the stuff of poems.
Does not my heat astound you, and my light?
Things that did not belong in poems before, selves that did not belong in poems before, now belong in poems.
It was a change of world. Thanks to Penn Sound, the Library of Congress, and the University of Arizona Poetry Center for access to audio recordings. Cindy Katz read Emily Dickinson. Much of the music came from guitarist and songwriter Khaki King, with additional music and sound design from Louis Mitchell. The editorial consultants are Honor Moore and Hannah Brooks Motel. Producer is Curtis Fox. The executive producer for the Poetry Foundation is Jim Sitar. To read more about the poets you just heard from, go to poetryfoundation.org. From the Poetry Foundation in Chicago, this has been A Change of World. I'm Meryl Streep.